I'll try to repeat the question. So, thank you very much, George. As you said, he and Ike snookered me into this talk, and once they did that, I gave him a lot of silence in return, so he wrote the blurb and so on. The first thing I'm going to do today is change the title on it. So, yes, maybe. Okay, so that doesn't work at all. It's a different display on my set than on that one.
It might be the resolution on your
phone. Okay, great. So now the problems begin. Okay. Anybody more familiar than I am with how to get this set up? What's that?
Triumph 11.
Put it on
off
real quick.
Yeah, thank you, Ike. Yeah, okay. Brilliant.
F5, F4, F7.
Just go through all of them. There's a button that's like, it mirrors your displays that's up in the top row of the machine. Have you tried rebooting your computer?
Ah, nice.
Are you trying installing Windows on your computer?
I'm glad of that. What are you running? What is this? Do you know? What is it?
It's just PowerPoint.
Okay, I didn't know. I've never actually seen PowerPoint.
The better side on the VGA.
I think
the
screen,
presentation on the main screen. So there's a preference in whatever you're using there to flip those. Somewhere in preferences. Open it in Google Docs.
Yeah. That's great.
Are you guys picking it? It changed. That what you want?
It is plugged in.
Awesome. All right. We could go with this.
You give maximize it the extemporaneous tags.
Yeah. All right, can everybody see that well enough so we can get going? All right, so I'm changing the title on them. Unix Programming in the Age of Frameworks. How many people here play a managerial role of some sort in their organization? Don't be shy, please, managers, don't be shy. Yeah, thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ike. Anybody else? No? I'm more than a little surprised, but let's continue. Fred, come on, you're not shy.
Well,
I did say organization. Right. Okay. Well, congratulations. You're a manager. Okay. So, yeah, can't see shit here, but that's the office. Anyway, so I've been managing programmers for a long time, and the adventure has grown in the last few years when I've gone into shops that had ongoing operations, relatively established teams, and you come in as the new guy and want to do something with these teams, and you want to try to change their environment and introduce some techniques that you've learned over the years that you think can help them. So about that, I have a tale. This is this relates to my first encounter with NiceBug. The first time I went to NiceBug, I actually went with a bunch of guys. It's a true story except for the bar part. It was a restaurant. But anyway, George was there. I walked in there. This was my first week at a new job, and somebody said to me, "Hey, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I just took a new job. I'm managing a group of programmers doing X, Y, and Z." "Oh, and it's a Java shop." And the guy turned to me and he said, "Well, you know, I learned Java last week, and you can learn it next week." So, I'll enjoy that smugness as much as the next guy, but on the other hand, what an endorsement of Java. Okay, so, what is the nature of this beast, this Java that we had to deal with at that job? People use it as a framework. It's one of these things that they think can solve all their problems, and that can do lots of magic for them, and that they don't really have to sweat the details, and therein lies the seduction. Okay, the seduction of frameworks. It's a universal solution. Business owners can understand that. They think that they buy this, and then the programmers just plug in, and their problems are relatively easy to address. They get to market quickly. programmers are portable, they can get a new one and fit that round peg into the round hole. Things work. And it's, of course, extensible. That's what the advertising blurbs say, right? And you don't have to sweat the details. Okay. And there are many to choose from. There are so many different do-it-all gadgets in the world of programming. So this is just, these are the numbers from a single Wikipedia page that talks about web app frameworks, very common thing, and as you can see, there are many, many choices. What does this mean, that there are so many choices for the thing that does everything? Surely we can conclude right now that... Thank you.
It doesn't matter what you're doing, it depends on how, what really matters is how you're doing it.
Anybody else?
A lot of things do nothing well. They're easy to write. And they do nothing well.
Java clearly has a majority.
Yes.
So. Not a viable language to pull a framework in.
Nice. So this brings me to the danger of these frameworks. It's conceptually misleading. It doesn't do all these things. It's not a universal solution. It's a very complex tool. And the markets are constantly changing. And so if you find a framework that adapts well to the market that you're in at the moment, what about tomorrow? The programmers that you hired in order to deal with this one framework that you have and who don't have expertise in other areas, how do they adapt to this changing environment? And how do they follow along with that without their dear framework? Can they? Sometimes it doesn't just work. I don't know how many of you have had the adventure of going through debugging or attempting to debug memory management in a large Java rig, but it's an adventure.
Why would you want to? That's garbage collection.
Right. So this brings me to the last one, which is that the details matter, right? The problem, one of the problems you have when you adopt a system that allows you to avoid the details is that when one of those details actually comes to the fore and does matter, you can find yourself out of business before you figured it out. And that's a rather precarious position to be in. So you can adopt these things. Maybe you do get quickly to market, but there is this big potential pitfall lurking there, or many of them. Now, I'm really primarily concerned here with the management of programmers in this setting, and I wanted to run through some things that you encounter with programmers when you try to extricate them from this framework problem. A lot of people who work extensively with frameworks, they lose track of the details. You know, just borrow the library. The library does it right. Thousands of people use the library. It's got to be good. Caring how programs really work under the hood. Not long ago, I had an encounter with a problem. My guys on the job had an encounter with a problem. They were doing some sort of ID translation. It was a natural place to do hash mapping. We were doing a lot of ETL, and this was the way we did it. And this was in the Java setting. And we were using some variety of in-memory hash table, and it was causing us lots of headaches. And I suggested at the time, you know, have you thought of trying something simple, like maybe loading a CDB with data and, just running through it, whatever. And I got two responses from different programmers. The first one said, well, really, that code just does the same thing. So, you know, we're not going to gain anything by doing that. And the other one said, well, I guess I have to make a sharded version of the CDB, but if I try that, let's see what happens. And he tried it, and there was a tenfold reduction in the first layer complexity of the code, and there was a tenfold increase in the performance of the code. So, unless you really want to know what's going on under the hood, and I presume most people here are part of this group because they do, you can run into a lot of obstacles like that. The problem that I see when encountering people who have spent a lot of time working in these frameworks is the loss of those underlying details. Measurements and speculation is the kind of the standard approach to that. And a lot of people say measure, don't speculate. How many would agree with that statement? Okay. My difficulty with that is that speculation is really powerful. And it's sometimes correct. And it's really cheap compared to measurement. So if used appropriately, it's a really good tool. And I would not accept the measure, don't speculate approach. But you have to apply tools as potent as speculation carefully. Anybody can do it, but can you do it and be right enough of the time to justify the disasters that can occur when you're wrong? Okay, or can you act to mitigate the cost? So the story I just told was a typical case of speculation and non-measurement. On the other hand, it was relatively cheap to try, so we tried it and it worked. But a lot of times, when you get into a situation where you're trying to guide these programs, you have to encourage the measurement, but you have to also temper the enthusiasm for the measurement because you can really go overboard measuring. The final two items on this list, I think, to me, are interesting because skill in general, this goes far beyond programming, it could apply to any endeavor, means, in essence, to me, accomplishing more while doing less. And so this is what programmers tend to focus on. They want to focus on being able to accomplish more programming using less of their own time. You can apply a library, and you can get some results out of it, and go on your way. And there are a lot of recommendations along those lines. That's not the same thing as scaling an operation. Scaling means accomplishing more while using less, using fewer resources. And programmer resources is just one example. So from my perspective, the question of skill is one that's very common and natural at the level of the programmer's operation. And the question of scale really is something that you have to grapple with when you're managing a group. And a lot of the situations I've encountered involve operations where they have something that works, more or less. They have to scale it. Now they hit the wall because they've taken all those shortcuts that got them to the operable state. And now they cannot scale because, again, they're locked in. They're taking for granted that things work as they expect. So suppose like me, you've got into a job and you had to deal with this. What do you do? I like the Unix approach to programming, and I think it's very applicable here. So let's start with the first obvious question: what is it? Is it a bunch of tenets or traditions that have been handed down from the elders for our enlightenment and our use?
Yes.
Standing on the shoulders of giants. Is it a more enticing proposition? Something that you can have fun with? Something that you can, you know, some adventure you can embark on? Anybody?
No.
All of the above. So what are the essential ingredients of Unix programming?
A C compiler.
Okay.
Small tools.
Yeah. Small tools, awk, a C compiler.
Build your tool to solve the simplest problems useful.
Simplest problem useful? Anything else?
Man pages.
Man pages. Where? Pipes.
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 Do one thing, do it well.
Okay, do one thing, do it well. So, again, this is not news for anybody here. I'm not inventing any of these ideas, but to me, these are the elements that matter the most in Unix programming. Simplicity. Modularity. Reusability. Factoring. And constructing solutions by creating constellations of tools. You have a kit of tools and you assemble them in some configuration to solve problem A. You assemble them in a different configuration to solve problem B. It's the same toolkit. So some of the information resides in the tools, but a lot of the information resides in how you configure that constellation. And that's a really powerful basic element in the Unix world that you often forego in the realm of these frameworks, because you know it's not really oriented toward that, and people don't think in those terms.
Is it more or less just use your programming? Like, a big way that you use Unix is by writing little programs.
Fair enough. If you're in that mindset. So, again, how do you get people into that mindset if they're not already? If they're used to running their, you know, if when they walk in this room, they tell you how big their Hadoop cluster is. How big is your cluster? Well, mine's 256 nodes, and I wrote this extension of something that makes it 64-bit. Oh, I forgot to mention that it slurps all the data.
So we should be asking how big your
toolkit is. There you go. So, what has Unix done for you lately? Who's used SH in the last week? How about awk? How about sed? You can keep the hand up. How about Perl? Oh, hissing and booting from the crowd. How about Python? And hoots and hollers. How about Java?
Do you mean use it in the direct sense? Or use a
framework that uses it. Yeah, I can use it.
Well,
I'm
saying.
How about GCC?
Yeah.
Actually, I didn't put one on the list. How about GDB? Okay. So that was actually more even than I expected. I only got one complaint about why I included Java on this list earlier today. It is a toolkit. There is a question of how big is your toolkit and how adept you are with your toolkit. So I'd like to take a little survey. Just don't be shy. I know you're not shy people. What's a Unix filter, anybody? Just shout it out.
Okay, it's
a Turing machine.
It's something that takes a stream, through extended input, makes some change or no change, and puts out a stream and extended output.
Okay, and why is that an important concept?
You can chain it.
Chain it. How?
So if you have a process that uses three filters, you can stick a fourth filter in the middle somewhere without changing the three.
Modularity in the stream.
Okay. So, just as an aside, these guys are probably going to give me a right hard time later, and the reason is in part that whenever I show up someplace, I ask everybody these questions. This is part of my list. Okay. When you show up, you got to figure out who's who and what's what, and understand you know, the people you're going to work with, and figure out where they meet, what they know, what they don't know, and so they've all seen all these questions, and I'm sure they're gonna extract a little payback later.
Unless you principles of usefulness that let you create ad hoc programs by recomposing previous.
Okay, good. So, how do TCP and UDP sockets differ? This is a BSD crowd, right? Stateful, stream-based.
Lossy.
Okay.
You read better.
You can't call the best TCP.
So we've reduced it to the definition of better, at least. Okay. How do INET and Unix domain sockets differ?
One
goes to localhost?
At least to localhost.
Okay.
And sockets shouldn't be your network stuff. It's basically a point in the system where you hand stuff off.
Okay, so say, what's the addressing convention for one and the other?
File systems manage you.
Okay, yeah.
So you have a place. I have a file, it's a socket file. And I go and read one from it.
So this is like a Windows name pipe.
You can pass arbitrary metadata over Unix domain socket like file descriptors and credentials.
All right, now we're digging into detail. Okay, so this is good. A little more. By the way, I love the caption on it. As I got this picture, the caption on this picture was called Redneck Plumbing.
Yeah, Redneck Plumbing.
That's good.
That's the INET.
Okay, so suppose you're working on a typical Unix box and you want to delete a file foo/bar. You own everything in sight. What permissions do you need?
Write permission.
Directory and run.
Write permission. Is that it?
Right on directory.
Right on directory.
Search on the directory.
Search on directory to find bar.
No, root log. Right.
The native lookup will fail if you don't have search history on the food directory.
You don't have to though. You don't have to enable it. It's certainly
common. Do you mean it's a delete bar or delete foo and bar?
I meant to delete bar.
Sometimes you have to get a reference file open or unlink or something like that, which will go through an AMI, which is going to have to traverse the tree, which is going to be...
Okay, so already we have an interesting topic for debate later, and somebody's going to whip out a machine and demonstrate one way or the other. Okay. That's part of the utility here, right? You can generate a little conversation.
No.
that's another debate.
Can't you just log into production? Ike's here. Okay, what's an atomic operation?
One that cannot be
divided. It either works or it doesn't.
Either it works or it doesn't. What did you say?
Cannot be divided.
Cannot be divided. In what sense?
Nothing can happen between the beginning of it and the end.
Okay, so can we characterize that in a more... operational sense?
It works for those entire days. No other operations see the operation half done.
Okay, so to any outside observer, you see the before state or the after state. Okay, so what file system operations are atomic?
Renaming.
Any directory operation?
Writes under 512 bytes.
Writes under 512 bytes.
A move across the same volume. Yeah. Within the same volume.
That's a remix.
Okay. So it's a little of an abrupt switch here, but I'm switching gears here. And what do these things mean in shell? There's dollar star.
All the same transactions in Oracle.
How about dollar at?
Same as dollar star, it's
okay. So
it's individually quoted.
So I've asked the four dollar star, dollar at, quoted dollar star, quoted dollar at. The most elementary shell question, pretty much. That's one approach. Okay. So the reason that I ask these questions is, again, to get the lay of the land, to understand what people know, what people don't know, to try to get people thinking about this level of detail. And the reason is that I believe that understanding this level of detail and mastering this level of detail really makes people better programmers and breaks them out of the habit of thinking of everything within the confines of their particular framework of choice. Okay, and so let's run with that. You know, what about Unix filters and pipelines? Well, the point is, several people mentioned earlier, is a modularity that they provide. And they have also a uniform interface, right? And it's extraordinarily simple. And they are not just a building block, but they are a self-similar building block. Okay? It's a very powerful element. So composition of pipelines, composition of filters in a pipeline creates a new pipeline. It's just that simple. And so if you become familiar with this, yes?
It also gives you the ability to inspect the state of what you're filtering in between. So you can break the pipeline and inspect the data at any point along the way.
True. Okay, so yeah, it's a flexible modularity because you can interject something, some TCP dump or whatever, as you were talking about earlier. Fred?
I think the key thing here is the interface. You're programming to an interface here, which is very, very simple and very easy to learn, very easy to remember.
Right.
Because it's very standardized even between components.
Well, and it's not merely standardized, it's rather universal.
Except the command line options.
The command line options meaning what?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a standard interface, you pipe in through standard in, and you get your data from standard out, but there's a myriad of ways to actually configure each pipeline. Whether they need dashes or not, whether you can group things, whether you need long versions or short versions. I kind of wish there was more uniformity in command line options.
Fair enough, but that's a question of the programs and not the question of the filter and pipeline construct. So,
you can punt on it, okay.
Great. The lessons that I want people to take from this when I'm working with them are, don't invent interface, because you already have this universal interface that's extremely flexible and extremely useful, and it has this wonderful algebraic quality, namely that composition produces a similar element. Okay, and that self-similarity you can leverage by interjecting some monitor, by recomposing things, by taking a pipeline that's composed of four elements and you decide later you need three to do it, and so you drop one and massage data in the other. It's a very useful elementary construct. So that's the beginning. You know, pipelining is the standard answer to the question, why is this a useful concept? But I think it's much better than that, because with the right sort of factoring, this becomes more broadly applicable. So my favorite example are the OOXPI services. Okay, and the reason is that this lets you do something interesting with a filter. So TCP server with an address and a Unix filter means your Unix filter is now a network server. And IPC server with a path and a Unix filter means now your Unix filter is a Unix domain network server. And SSL server with an address and a filter, and you've got a secure network server. So all of a sudden you've achieved something very powerful based on that concept of filter. Yes, my friend?
Secure.
Yes.
Substitute for encrypted.
I said SSL, right? Okay. So the power in this factoring comes from the fact that you can solve a simple problem. Write a Unix filter. And then, by virtue of good factoring, you can deploy this in a much broader context. Create a network service. That's really excellent factoring. You had a comment?
Yeah. Here's a problem. You want to filter a file, through various things, but the file is compressed, and the things you're going to filter it through, and it can't, you're not going to...
They don't drop compressed data.
You're not going to change each of a thousand things to deal with the decompressing and detecting whether it's compressed, and you're not going to do the same thing for encryption. You want the pipe mechanism to be able to automatically decompress something that's being passed through it.
Why?
Yeah, it's
GZCAT.
Yeah.
No, but you're controlling where the first part of it. If you've got a bunch of filters, they may encounter something.
Look, if you're feeding data into a program that it doesn't understand, you're feeding data into a program it doesn't understand.
Okay.
Right. So you have to make that arrangement.
Well, there's something that grabs all the files in the directory, and some of them are encrypted and some are not. And instead of having to filter which ones are,
but now we've progressed beyond the filter. The point
of the talking solution to that, CCAT minus F. It will cat files that are not encrypted. Compressed, and it will decompress and cat files that are compressed.
So look, again, let me try to focus this on the programming team. Okay, you're a manager. You're trying to address people the question of how to get people to use these facilities that you all in this room are fairly familiar with, but they're not, and try to get them to start thinking in these terms and get themselves out of the box that they're in with the framework, Fred.
So this is an excellent framework. I mean, I think you have a I think you have a framework, Andy. Shh. All right.
Okay. So, leverage factoring. Can you tell I worked with him before? Only I didn't teach him any of this stuff. All right, another example. So, file systems and data. One example, a directory-based queue. You have a queue, you toss some file in it, then you go through that queue, you set things to a working state, there's another directory, you work on them, you set them to done or to fail, depending on what happens. Okay? This is a crude form of database. Among us who have been around for a long time, this is a standard idea from way back when. But people don't think of this at all anymore. A file system is a database. It's now an alien concept. And you can query this database with LS and with find. And you can accomplish transactions with MV. Okay? It's really simple. The missing link is idempotency. So if you can arrange things so that your operations are idempotent, then any failure in advance of that final commit, you know, the MV is essentially the commit of the transaction. You can rerun those and commit again.
So basically, being conscious and sober.
Being conscious and sober?
Yes.
You set a high bar, my friend.
It's like CV mate.
Okay, so what is the point here? The point is that you have this very powerful, underutilized tool at hand. You have a file system. But nobody knows how to use this tool, in my experience. Very few people know how to use this tool. So exploit the tools at hand. And use the file system as your ad hoc database. And mind the details. Make sure you understand the details so that you can do this effectively.
What's wrong with this real life?
Nothing's wrong with SQLite.
Yeah, it's one file. It works wonders.
There's the SQL part. There's the Lite part. Okay. So let me go back to this question about scale as accomplishing more while using less. okay? Because that's in the end what we're trying to accomplish with this. Again, when I had to deal with these circumstances, generally the problem has been you have an operation that's working, but they can't scale it. Why? Because the details aren't right. Because the magical framework that's supposed to handle all these things for you doesn't, in fact. And you have to figure out the details, and you have to decompose things, and you have to refactor so that you can accomplish these things. I recently heard a story of retirement of some machines at a company that I used to work at nearby, and
if, not yet retired.
Even better.
You're dreaming. It's not happening.
Even better. Okay, so what about these machines? They were based on the mighty Pentium 3, and they sported 128 megs of RAM.
Yes.
And there were six of them. And they served DNS and HTTP redirects for almost 10 years in a production setting. Okay, for a fairly heavily used system.
Well, I mean, the redirects have been out for a while.
What, a couple of years, right? Brian, how long has it been out?
What, 3 years.
3 years, okay. I take it back. They only did redirects globally for 7 years. Okay. This is leverage. This is scale. Okay? Deploying something that doesn't really look very powerful and doing a lot with it. Okay?
So ChrisBox is doing a DNS.
Stuff like that. Okay, so...
Well, you should probably mention that they do DNS for at least 700 domains.
That's true. Okay, did everybody hear that? That's DNS set up for about 700 domains.
Does that have a track?
Enough to support many billions of emails.
Tens of millions of emails per month.
Right. What's that?
Well, for domains, the real issue is how big is the zone file that you're dealing with, if you're doing fine.
I don't know,
like, what are you using? But no, it's really
about
how big your DNS, how big your
cache. Let me put it this way.
How fast is your zone reload?
Yeah.
How can you say best and bind together?
I can tell you this. At some point, we turned off logging of the requests because that inhibited performance.
Okay.
That was Fred. Who did that? Okay, so
now we don't know what's going on anymore.
So
it's just raining weeds.
So we do have a framing tool in Unix, and it's shell. That's my contention. Okay, and the reason that this is really useful for everybody to learn, and I have to ask, how many people here consider themselves expert in shell?
Okay. Shell?
Any shell will do. Okay. I'm a little surprised at that. And perhaps that's a little more frank assessment than I expected.
I think you have a high degree of foreigners. They're more restricted on the experts.
Would you count a deaf rather than expert?
Yes, sure, why not?
Okay.
They're
scared just like English.
Exactly, yes. And if you weren't scared when you first saw it, you were a fool. But,
I know some guys who know they're experts in
jail. Sorry. I think Pearl's taking over a lot of that.
So, Pearl is one of those languages, my background, I am very good in shell. I'm very good in Perl. But to me, the two are utterly dissimilar in the sense that the emphasis on Perl is, the kitchen sink approach. Perl can do everything for you. But the things that shell does, it does so badly. Using external tools to accomplish something is effortless in shell, and it's nightmarish in Perl.
Which PCL, except for this PCL, if they can't find it, it'll spawn it. Or Steam Shell.
Don't go there.
Steam Shell, okay. I should have said SH. So I try to get people to understand and use shell more often, because I think this is what turns you outward from your framework and toward the toolkit that's lying all around you in the Unix system. The emphasis is on the collection of external tools. The shell is built precisely in order to facilitate stringing together those tools and constructing that constellation of tools that comprises your solution. And it's very easy to refactor and adapt. We already heard comments to that effect, right? It's very easy to interject some sort of monitoring if you need to or want to, and it frees you to focus on the data flow architecture and rather than on the library interfaces or anything, because again, you stopped reinventing interface. You stuck to this very simple, very universal, self-similar approach. And so...
Shell
programs and pipes. I mean, I think shell is the setting in which you can explore that most readily.
Well, no, pipes, I can give you... Shell is probably the least portable, even temporarily, just let it sit there. Things go strain because someone changed the options when you upgraded the system.
Right. Okay. Change the options on what?
One of the executables.
Okay, that's not a shell issue, but I can see the
point. Shell issue. I wrote a program in shell, part of your complaint about shell or your thing. I can magically call these things and it just works. Just works is it works later too.
I did not say you magically call these things and works. In fact, that's one of my chief complaints. So here, I'll give you an example because I know what you're talking about. Once upon a time, I wrote a shell program that did a bunch of stuff, and among those things was a tar command. Okay? It unpacked something. And I wanted to be able to detect errors, and at the time what I did was to capture standard error from this whole pipeline, because one of the problems with shell, at least old-fashioned shells, is that it's hard to capture intermediate errors. But I made sure to arrange that every intermediate program said something on standard error so that I could detect that. So I captured standard error and looked at standard error, and if standard error was empty, then I knew that nothing intermediate had failed. Okay? Then some bright bulb at the GNU project changed the way tar works. Okay?
Yeah.
And tar puked on standard error every time it unpacked something to tell you how much work it had done for you.
Okay.
Okay? And that's not a shell problem, but it sure is a tool problem.
It's a shell problem, because for the sake of argument, written in a real programming language or scripting language, you would have had the consistency of not having to depend on all this other stuff that I hope it works later.
I disagree in the following sense. This is a question of having changed the interface, and somebody can do the same stupid thing with the library interface as they did in this case, which was a command line interface. And I do not believe that those are different levels of problem. It's somebody changing the semantics without changing the name on the
interface. In a real programming language, you're going to use a tar library, and some bright bulb at the tar library company changed the API. You're going to have the same exact.
Exactly.
So Mark is going to start running an open tar project.
Right.
It's much easier to do error checking against the library than against an executable where you're looking at exit codes and the standard results of standard error.
Well, I'm not so sure. In this case,
I mean, it wouldn't even link. I mean, or I would see some error like tar's interface.
That's not always true.
There are trade-offs.
But it's easier to do error checking in real life, in quote-unquote real languages.
I don't know. This was a runtime change, right? So this,
it's an opinion.
What's that?
I express an opinion.
Yeah. Sir?
Another problem that is close to what you just said is if someone added stuff to standard output that you didn't want, you'd add into the pipeline something like rep minus p, and
yeah,
you get rid of it. But if they do the standard error, pipelines only work with standard input and standard output. They don't see standard error. So you can't get rid of the message so easily.
So it's, I certainly don't want to claim that these things always work, and I certainly don't want to let the tool writer or creator off the hook. If they change the tool and don't change the way you call the tool in order to see that change, then they've broken it, in my opinion. They've changed the tool without touching the interface, and so they've essentially set everybody up for this problem. And I think that that's wrong when you are working with a library, and I think that's wrong when you're working with the command line interface. And I would say that the problem lives at the same level in those two cases. And that, you know, tool makers should be taken to task for that, because that's bad behavior, that's incompatibility.
The framework's got to account for that. And I think that's part of what I think is a very, very valid point. I'm not defending the idiocy of people who are, you know, changing sites or anything else at all. But I do think a tool needs to take into account, and that might, that's where Mark's argument does have some validity. Thus, again, this is why everybody should be endorsing Rain working on OpenCVS.
API, it doesn't matter where it exists, you know, if you can support it, and, you know, you're not going to support it, but the point is the error. Okay. Well, that's still part of the API.
This was a change of behavior that had no remedy. There was no way to turn this off. When they first introduced this, there was no shutting it off, and so they just broke everything entirely.
How
I think there's a way to turn it off. Anyway. Okay. So I think that, you know, you have to get people out of that box. You have to kind of try to invert their world and get them to, you know, having this conversation, right? Having this argument about what is the right way to deal with interface and changes in behavior and how to accommodate that, but in the setting of a toolkit, not in the setting of a framework that does everything for you and that embodies all the magic so that everything you do, you think of as doing in Perl or doing in Python or doing in Java. And you can accomplish that, I think, by looking at these, focusing on these elements. Some parting thoughts. Going back to the tool question now, tools do become more complex over time, but they're still specialized. You know, this, I think the nice place to look for this this lesson is actually outside of programming in any other industry. The tools do become more complex. They do more. They do it. They make it easier for you to accomplish the job. They do have new failure modes. And so they break more often. And better tools are a useful thing, but better factoring gives you something different. It allows you to apply the same tool in a broader or more flexible setting. That's the lesson of the OOPsPy services based on filters. And the final thought I have for you is that it's important to make the tools replaceable, because that's actually the measure of modularity that you want. You can make a library, and it's all fine and good, but it's tightly coupled in terms of interface or whatever to the rest of what you do, then it's not replaceable in a way that is most useful. And that's, again, another reason why the pipeline concept is so powerful, I think, and why it's useful to introduce to people. So that's it. Thank you for listening, and I'm glad we had some good back and forth, and maybe we can go out to the bar and have some more.